morning and welcome to Chai Haven, a program about everything Jewish in our community. Jennifer Klein and Jim Berger are Jewish in our community. They also teach at Yale University. They're married, raising a family in New Haven, and they're activists who work tirelessly to make our community more just. A quest that you might say is Jewish, you might say is not specifically Jewish, or we might talk about that today to probe that question. Jim and Jennifer are here to talk about that in the WNHH studio. Thanks for joining us. Good morning, Jennifer, and good morning, Jim. So nice to see you both.
All right. Hello. Thanks for having us.
So a lot's been going on in New Haven and in Connecticut in activist circles. Last night we had a march at Yale in support of a student whose father is being deported in ICE custody. Were you guys at that demonstration last night, 400 strong?
Yes, but we had kids.
It's okay, you can't be at every demonstration, a lot of them. And in fact, Jennifer, we got the idea of doing this show because you were recently arrested in Hartford at an immigrants' rights demonstration. You folks have been present at a lot of the immigrant rights demonstrations that have taken place in New Haven since Donald Trump was elected and cracked down on immigration policy. So what were you doing up in Hartford recently, Jennifer?
Well, this was in defense of the Ramos family, whose parents have lived in the United States for 24 years, but they were now being slated for deportation. They have two American-born sons, one of whom is a minor, and ICE just, you know, decided this is the time to now send them out of the country back to Ecuador, where they haven't lived.
The whole family or the father?
No, just the parents.
And ICE is Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Correct.
So there is this gentleman is one of the several who are being kept in places of worship, right? Sanctuary churches. He's in Meriden.
Well, it's, over the summer, there have been different people who have taken refuge in churches in New Haven. A mother of four children.
Also, that was Nuri in New Haven. I saw you guys at that demonstration. Yes. And now she got she was able to stay. She was going to be deported. She fled to the church.
And right. And the case of Luis Barros over the summer. And now somebody in the church on
First and Summerfield.
Yes. So so we've been paying quite close attention to this. I think it's an issue for us that really hits home on a personal level, since our parents and grandparents were immigrants and refugees, but also on the level of what does it really mean to have a just and inclusive community.
So your parents were, I know they're immigrants, I know they're refugees. Who, refugees from where?
Which one of us?
Either.
My grandparents were not refugees, but they came to the United States in 1920 from Hungary.
Uh-huh.
Part of Hungary, which is now actually Ukraine, and they were.
And Jim, I should get closer to the mic if you don't mind.
Sorry, they were part of that enormous wave of immigration right
that
before.
That was the tail end. The
tail end, exactly.
My father came at the beginning, near the beginning of that, and he had fled pogroms in Russia.
So they were legal immigrants at a time when there were actually no immigration laws. So it was easy to be legal at that time.
And how about your Jim?
My father and aunt and grandparents came later in the 1940s. They were from Czechoslovakia, Hungary. And once the war was underway, my grandfather was a prisoner in a Nazi labor camp.
Oh, my goodness.
And my father and my aunt were young children with my grandmother. And my grandfather was actually able to escape from the camp and went back to get the family. And they decided to go into hiding and to hit the road. But my grandmother was also a twin. And she and her twin sister were separated in 1941. And while my grandmother survived the Holocaust, ultimately, her twin sister did not. And she died with her children in the war. And so my family was in hiding and trying to move through Europe, moving through about six countries of Europe during the war, and eventually reached Spain, where people hid them. And then when trying to cross the border from Spain to Portugal, they were arrested and detained there for a while. And eventually got to Lisbon, where Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society could house them in refugee housing. until they could bring them as refugees to the United States.
So you, your family's had firsthand experience with immigration laws where the crime is defined as trying to stay alive and living somewhere.
Right. And so when I look at it, I think, you know, it's purely an accident of my birth that I'm an American citizen. I could have ended up anywhere in the world, as in fact happened to the other relatives in my family. And so I went with a group organized by Unidad Latina en Acción up to Hartford a few weeks ago. And this included also some students from Wesleyan, students from Yale, and community members, and two pastors and a Catholic priest. And we decided that we would sit down in front of the federal building in Hartford, where the ICE offices are located, to put our bodies on the line and say that we will defend members of our community. We will oppose this policy.
And what was happening inside the courthouse that day?
People were going to be having their hearings.
Including the man from Meriden.
So we wanted to be able to, you know, for however long is possible, to be able to block entrance into the building.
Now, when you do that, you know that eventually people are going to get inside, but that you're risking arrest to say we want to disrupt action as usual, the routine of what happens in the criminal justice system, to call attention to what is wrong with the system. Is that an accurate way to put it?
Absolutely. I mean, with this civil disobedience action, the idea is to say that the legal workings of the state are morally offensive, are ethically wrong, and we will stand in obstruction of them.
So what happened when you got up there? So you went, how many of you went in front of the door?
36 people. I think that's a couple more than were originally planned, but there were people who were in the group of witnesses who
decided to
join the line.
And you were expecting to get arrested?
Yes, in this case.
It's not the first time you've been arrested at a demonstration. You were arrested in New York, in New Haven, right? Labor demonstrations, climate change, I don't remember what it was.
Right. And I've been arrested in several different kinds of actions and under different kinds of terms, sometimes where it was set in advance, or the police knew in advance that this was the action that would be taken. I've also been arrested under conditions where I had no intention of being arrested, and the police actually created a situation where people ended up in a street and they rounded people up.
So now you're a professor, a tenured professor at Yale. You're widely read. You've published in great books. You're on CNN. You know, you write for the New York Times. Why would some people would look at you who don't know you and say, this is a very successful person. She's made it in America. Her voice is heard. Why would she have herself go get arrested on behalf of people I've never heard of?
Well, first of all, as I say, my personal experience is that we came here as refugees and somehow we had the right to be in this country and to thrive. And so I think people should have that basic opportunity. Secondly, I am a historian and I teach the history of social movements, and I teach the history of how people organize in their communities, how they create the solidarities that enable them to gain self-determination over their lives, that enable them to create genuinely democratic communities, that enable them to pursue economic and social justice and win those victories. And the fact is in the historical moments when those happen, it's because people acted collectively. They were able to figure out how you cross the boundaries of ethnicity, of language, of race, and they actually were willing to, in fact, take the risks of being in the spaces where you sort of stop the works, right? Where you bottle things up. And that's been true of the labor movement, of the women's movement, of different kinds of civil rights movements, of American Indian movements, and farm workers movements. And so I know from the history that this is what it takes. And I believe that as a citizen, and I mean that with a kind of, you know, small c, as an engaged person in a democracy, it's my obligation to be part of that with other people.
All right, so let's listen to a clip. Facebook Live, you were actually, before you got arrested that day, you're blocking the entrance in the morning in the federal building in Hartford, and someone put on Facebook Live what you said as everyone gathered before the police carted you away. Let's hear some of that.
New Year and repentance is an idea called Tikkun Olam. Repair the world. Heal the world. This is what we have to do now. This is what the Ramos family is asking us to do. Make sure that we defend them and other families as part of our community and part of our world, that we will heal and that we will work for justice here. My family came here 75 years ago as refugees. My father was born in Czechoslovakia and my aunt in the middle of war-torn Europe. My grandfather was in a Nazi labor camp and they came here as refugees. They were able to come here, but my family was scattered across the world. To Bolivia, to Uruguay, to Panama, to the Middle East. We want families to be together. We want people to flourish in America, as I ultimately was able to do, because my father and my aunt and my grandparents could come here and could live that life. I will stand with all of these people to make sure that what happened to my family in the 1940s doesn't happen to anybody. This is our justice project. This is what we will stand for, and this is what we will work for. Tikkun Olam. Thank you.
All right, that was Jennifer Klein in front of the federal building in Hartford a few weeks ago when she got arrested with other immigrant rights activists to protest deportation by ICE under the new crackdown on immigration by the Trump administration. And you're also in the studio listening to Jennifer Klein and Jim Berger, who are talking about activism and Judaism and the work they do here on High Haven at WNHH Radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. So you made a choice there, Jennifer. You were subsequently arrested. You were there. There weren't many Jewish people there. And you started talking about Tikkun Olam, the Jewish concept of repairing the world. What inspired you at that moment to give a speech about Tikkun Olam in this setting?
Well, first, I began thinking about the fact that there was something significant that this act was taking place in the week between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And that really provoked me to think deeply about its meaning spiritually and ethically, as well as politically. And also, I feel like in so much of the activism, it is often put in a very Christian setting. The ministers are there on the line with us, as they were.
And their prayers, and they say prayers, like you participate.
Yes,
in those
I
prayers?
Think the priest did a benediction and a prayer. And so I felt that, you know, it was important to interject something about Jewish tradition into this setting, because it really spoke so directly to our ethical sense about what it does mean to take responsibility, to be active in the world. Justice, justice shall you pursue, mm-hmm. as Deuteronomy said. And so I decided to, that was an entirely impromptu statement that I made. But I wanted to connect it to these Jewish imperatives and the project of Tikkun Olam. And that is really what motivated me. And first of all, I was surprised that somebody had recorded it. I didn't know that.
Who happens to be Jewish? You grew up in this area?
Right, Abby Feldman, and right. Who is also quite active. And then also a number of students came up to me afterwards and thanked me for giving that statement, because it turned out, in fact, that a number of the students who were in jail with me are actually Jewish. And so there were people who appreciated hearing those words and putting those thoughts into motion that connected what they know is something righteous to do with some heritage that might have been very distant in their mind or more immediate.
Yeah, yeah. If I can interject a couple of things about what Jen did. First, it took a lot of courage. And I think what we're facing now in the age of Trump is going to call for actions that take increasing amounts of courage. And we're not sure yet of what type that courage is going to be. In earlier arrests, things were much easier. In some of our New Haven arrests, for example, the police were just so super friendly. Everything was just nice and no real consequence following from it. And this, not as nice. And, you know, Jen is going to have to do 3 full days of service up in Hartford. You know, she asked to have it made in New Haven. No, it's going to be in Hartford because that's where the crime was committed. And of course, the question is, well, what was exactly the crime here? So first of all, I think we're facing a situation where activists are going to have to see, well, what sort of courage they're going to be able to summon. Second of all, it has to be collective. It has to be as a group. And here, I think the idea of tikkun olam, of healing the world, which is this Jewish imperative, which is you know, and as the Talmud says, we're not obligated to complete the work of tikkun olam, but neither are we free to desist from it. We have to participate in some way. It has to be collective. And so we run up against, I think, this other hugely important Jewish idea, which is tzedakah, which means righteousness, but which is often, I think, interpreted or, you know, conceived of as charity. One gives tzedakah, one gives charity. And I think that's not, I mean, that's necessary. But what, you know, my kind of criticism of tzedakah in that sense is that it helps the poor in their poverty. It helps the oppressed in their oppression. It does not take measures to structurally change what is creating poverty and what is creating oppression. And so it's not genuinely tikkun olam.
So in addition, so you need tikkun olam, those are 2 separate ideas. Because, you know, a lot of times when people say, what does it mean to be Jewish in modern America? Now, were you both raised Jewish? Did you go to synagogue ever? Did you have B'nai Mitzvahs?
What can I say? I was raised Reform. so yes, I was bar mitzvahed in a minimal way. But
how about you, Jennifer? Were you raised at all aware of Jewishness?
Yes. I mean, we would light Friday night candles, and have Shabbat dinner with my grandparents. So we always belonged to a synagogue, and I was certainly raised Jewish. And we went to Israel a couple of times. My brother's bar mitzvah was in Israel, and actually I did a semester in high school in Israel. However, I would say that my parents, or at least my father's sense of Judaism, was much more about social engagement in the world. He was a criminal defense attorney. He did cases often pro bono, especially if people were facing something like a death penalty charge. And my parents were always political activists. And so they would take me to rallies and marches.
The way you now bring your kids.
Yes. And
that's sweet.
Although our kids are really resisting at this point. I'm a little concerned about that.
But you're teaching them to be resistors.
Exactly. And I think, yeah, our lawyer fathers for both of us. My dad was also a lawyer. He was one of the founders of the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania branch of the ACLU.
Whoa.
He spent a summer, I think it was either 63 or 60. It was the summer in the South where the civil rights workers, Schwerner and the others, were killed.
Chaney and Goodman.
He was in Louisiana at that time.
Wow.
And
So the reason I asked you about this and how you brought it up, because some people are brought up, especially in the liberal movements of Judaism, to see tikkun olam and tzedakah, but especially tikkun olam, as a defining aspect of what it means to be Jewish. That we're part of a world right now that we're supposed to help make better and pursue justice. And that then some people who are more conventionally religious, although I would argue that every movement you can be equally religious, they just define with a different view of what that means, but that it's less of a central part of, let's say, some Orthodox, like, or they might define tikkun olam differently. It might be the food drive.
Right.
And you were talking about the underlying conditions. Like, we have a tikkun olam committee, the synagogue you can I go to at Beth El Kisra does great work with you know, with food drives and helping the homeless, and then also looking at the, trying to look at the roots, whether it's helping the immigration reform. Some people, other people say, well, that's not really what being Jewish means. Like, how central is it to you, Tikkun Olam, in terms of what it means to be Jewish? And in reverse, how central is being Jewish in the activism you guys do?
I think that being Jewish is absolutely essential to what I do and has always informed my activism ever since I was at rallies and marches with my parents as a child. And I also believe, though, that if we're going to have a democratic society, everybody needs to have the capacities in some form. You know, obviously people have a spectrum of abilities or capabilities, but to have the ability to achieve some human flourishing and some enjoyment in life, some control over their time, and some self-determination over their lives. And that doesn't come through just acts of charity. It also comes through enabling people to be able to do those things. And so the kinds of movements that we're involved in as solidarity movements are, you know, where we see people participating and building up their capacities and building movements and institutions
and
that give them
that
control.
How do you feel as a Jew in those movements in New Haven? Because as a reporter who's covered them for decades, I don't see a high percentage of Jews in, let's call them, left-wing grassroots social movements. Do you think that's true? Or
I think a lot of, you know, non-practicing Jews are there. Abby, you know, and Abby's not entirely non-practicing, but, you know, she's there.
She's who took the video. She's union organizer.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So I think Jews are there, but it to make us, you know, as Jews in the movement, I think is important to remind people, you know, where did all this Christian stuff come from? I think to really emphasize these historically Jewish ideas is, I mean, we've tried to do that. Back when in the beginnings of the movement that became New Haven Rising, the meetings were always started with a prayer, and often with a specifically Christian prayer. And Jennifer and I, you know, were sort of behind the scenes, you know, look, come on, give us a break. This is not the only way to do this.
And what, but you know, I know,
and it worked. It worked.
Yes,
tell me what happened with those prayers. I mean, there are reverends who are trying. So New Haven Risers is a movement affiliated with Yale's unions who bring on larger social issues organized at a neighborhood level to get people elected, to put pressure on Yale to hire more local people. And so when you were involved early on with that, Christianity was such a main mover. I mean, since the civil rights movement and before,
Absolutely. It's
what gets people involved. So like for me, I've never been uncomfortable with when people invoke Jesus, because that's such a concept that motivates people to do this work. But do you feel isolated? That
we feel there are other forms of motivation and other forms of solidarity.
But now you're trying
well,
to
that's
mold
what the
what
movement
will motivate
has
people.
To work. Yeah. I mean, that's what the movement has to work on, right? Is, you know, as it started out, it was trying to figure out, okay, how do you tap into what is going to not just motivate people, but give them the courage to stand up to power? That's a big thing, especially if you're talking about your employer or, you know, your job or some large institution or the federal government. What is going to give people that solidity and that inspiration and that courage to stand up to power? And so the first, I think the first yeah. move on that front was, you know, to have an explicitly Christian framing. But we did talk to people a lot and say, well, I don't think that's going to be enough of a base of solidarity, right? That if we're going to build a base of solidarity that's going to bring people together throughout the city across neighborhoods, we have to develop a new framing, a new language that makes that possible. And I think, you know, it's not that... I would agree with Jim that the prayers used to be explicitly Christian and would end with in the name of Jesus, and they're not there now.
Really?
But but what I would also say is, why is it that the institutional framing of religion seems so separate from work that goes on in the community, because, you know, in the institution of a synagogue, for example, people are doing what they see as important community work. As you say, working at the food bank, doing Habitat for Humanity, building housing. And yet, why is it that institutional expression of Jewish community work is so separate from all these needs of bringing together a broader community? And I remember, actually, as we were building around the New Haven in a Social Contract idea 15 years ago, going to a church in Fairhaven and hearing a Latino pastor speak, and he was speaking about the story of Esther and saying, look, Esther stood by her people, okay? Esther stood by her people. And I thought, wow, I didn't even know that Christians read the book of Esther. I had no idea. And so for me, this was a bridging moment. I appreciated that. And through something like New Haven Rising, it has brought us into neighborhoods across the city and people's homes across the city, and has brought them into homes in Westville, which would not otherwise happen. And if we think about unions, which yeah. is an incredibly important piece of this picture, unions, when we look at the service sector and other places, these are the most multicultural institutions we have going in American life. If you look at a hospital workers' union, all right, these are workers across ethnicity, across race, and across the educational spectrum, or, you know, a teacher's union. And so I think in the way that they enable people to be political participants, in the way that they speak about the notion of a just standard of living and people's ability to make that determination on their own and to stand up to forms of concentrated power, they are essential to rebuilding a democratic society. And so for us, one of the things that's been so important about activism in New Haven is precisely the community organizing labor alliance. And as Jews, I think we feel a natural part of that, because Jews yeah. were part of building that labor movement.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, the decline of the labor movement has been politically and economically a disaster, obviously. I mean, it is hard to imagine a President Trump had there still been a strong union movement in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, if there had been some way for working class people to, you know, to have some other form of political expression other than this, these forms of racial resentment which were made. There's this great line in this wonderful Leonard Cohen song, which you probably know, Paul, Democracy is Coming to the USA, the sacred places where the races meet. And that is one thing that New Haven Rising, for example, and the unions at their best have been able to bring together. And so those are kind of sacred spaces of the creation of social justice and of real democracy.
And we're bringing together Jim Berger and Jennifer Klein in discussion about that subject on High Haven, your program about everything Jewish in our community on New Haven Community Radio Station, WNHH-FM, broadcast at 103.5 FM, live streamed on New Haven Independent. org. Now, you guys are also, and this is tied in with the other activism you do, very active in your neighborhood. You live in Westville. You're active in political campaigns, right? Oh, you're shaking your head yes and no.
Yeah.
Tell me, so how do you see that? That's grassroots within the grassroots. Why is it important? And does this have anything to do with being a Jew, to be active in your neighborhood?
I don't know. Maybe.
Okay. Yeah, or how did you make the decision? Now, you're also active in a synagogue. How do you make that decision? People have limited amounts of time. You have two young children you're raising, two beautiful daughters, and you're active in social movements. You have very demanding jobs. Jim, you teach American Studies and English Literature at Yale, and Jennifer, you teach history, and you talk about social movements, women's history, labor movement, and you're writing so much. Why do you make a decision to be involved in a synagogue, and how does that fit in? Because that's a different kind of space, even though a lot of synagogues like our own tend to vote for Barack Obama in big numbers, but then there are other synagogues that don't. How do you make a decision to be involved in a Jewish institution like that, solely Jewish, and how does that fit in with how you see yourselves as part of a community?
Well, we see ourselves as Jewish, and to practice Judaism in some formal way. I mean, we're not hugely observant, but I don't know, we belong. I wouldn't say we're particularly active in the synagogue.
I mean, show up well, was sort of more than most
yes,
Americans
we,
do.
And
most
well, when
Americans
our,
of all faith do yeah, not go to their yeah, houses
we,
of worship.
We show up.
Yes, and I would say, first of all, I mean, when we moved to New Haven, we did not have children, but we did join a synagogue right away. We did join Beth El Kesser Israel. So we were members of the synagogue for a number of years, actually, before we had children. And then once we had children, we certainly wanted our children to clearly be raised Jewish. And so we started attending the children's Havarah group immediately from the time that they were infants. So they have gone to a children's service, on a fairly regular basis ever since then. And we do make sure that, you know, we light Friday night candles and we do go on all of the holidays. So so we clearly want them to make that association. And then I think we've been spending a long time thinking about what is the way in which we reconcile our political commitments, our intellectual work, our teaching, and what we consider as Jewish practice and Jewish spirituality. And so we do attend often some of the reading or discussion things that are held on certain holidays so that we can do that work of thinking, what does Judaism mean to us in this period of the 21st century? I don't think it's easy. But we, for example, support groups like Jews for Racial and Economic Justice in New York. And, the incredible work they do, they have done things such as worked as partners with Domestic Workers United to pass a Domestic Workers Bill of Rights in the state of New York. So crossing class and racial boundaries to do that. They've worked on police reform issues. They have a Shalom Bayit housing justice project. So, and we went, when we went to the Women's March in January, we specifically made a point of marching with Jewish groups at that. It was Workman's Circle and
a kick-ass klezmer band there. It was just, yeah, it was a very nice feeling to be with the Jews at the Women's March the day after the Trump inauguration. It was very, very powerful.
And why was that?
Why was that powerful? I don't know. I don't know why it was that
powerful. I'm trying to
get
at what it is about your Jewish identity that is important to you as you're an activist.
Yeah. You know, as I say, I grew up, my mother insisted that we go to Friday night services and that I get bar mitzvah. And I'll tell you, the day after my bar mitzvah, I didn't show up in that temple.
Same here.
Again.
Same for 20
ever,
years. Yeah.
Ever. And then I went to college in New York, and I lived in New York. And, you know, in New York, as you know, everyone's Jewish, right? The black people are Jewish. The Puerto Ricans are Jewish. Everyone's Jewish. It's just
true.
Not a
I was
question.
Recently in Phoenix, and I saw an African-American street musician the middle of the night, and he said, "Good Shabbos."
Yeah, exactly.
I said, "Whoa." And he said, "I'm from New York."
Then,
I'm from New York.
Then, you know, then I went to, after some years, I went to graduate school at University of Virginia, which is where I met Jennifer. And then, my God, what a change.
Which campus?
Charlottesville.
Charlottesville.
Oh my
Charlottesville.
God.
We were Jewish students.
At Charlottesville, at UVA. And, all these blonde, it was like I was not in Kansas as AKA New York anymore.
But you were in Kansas.
I was in Kansas. Yeah, exactly. At that point, weirdly enough, I felt I have to find the Jews.
Interesting.
I have to find them.
You hadn't been in a synagogue for 10 years, or 8 years.
I went to Hillel, and that's where I actually met Jennifer. Although I should mention, I taught in Tanzania for 3 years in my late 20s. And there at the school where I taught, there was one other Jewish guy, Dan Cohen. And Dan Cohen and I would always do a Seder. And the 3 years that we were there together, we always did a Seder. And we made our own matzah. We rolled out the dough with empty beer bottles. And we would always invite some goyim you know, there for the Seder. We would have a Seder. And so it was, you know, it was a good thing. So yeah, no, I think becoming a more self-consciously identifying Jew came in Charlottesville with this perceived necessity as I was in this ocean of
What were you doing at the university there?
I was getting a PhD in English.
All right.
And actually, I have to say, when I was leaving New York to go to graduate school at the University of Virginia, and my parents, who were divorced and probably hadn't spoken to each other in years, both separately said, "Are there any Jews there?" So
now that you know that you're going to Charlottesville, Virginia, to meet your Jewish match.
Darn
right.
They must have cavil.
We became legendary at the UVA.
How so?
Well, because, I mean, they're always trying to hook up Jewish students with each other. It always fails.
So now, what did you think recently when that horrible hate rally took place in Charlottesville and Nazis were there?
Yeah.
And what stunned me about that one, reading it, was I knew there were anti-Semites in America, but, you know, the big fight is racial for African-Americans and Latinos. And at that event, they singled us out again. I said, whoa, this
Crazy.
Isn't over.
Yeah,
what were
no,
you thinking?
I mean, it deeply shook me to my core to think here are Nazis marching with torches on a campus where we were Jewish students, where we met precisely because there was, you know, this vibrant Jewish institution and our dissertation advisors were Jewish, you know, half the department is Jewish. And so that was profoundly disturbing. And yeah, to see how explicit the anti-Semitism was, I think was frightening.
So then you joined, you're in a network of people who do activism in New Haven, union activism, immigration reform activism. Through that network, you showed up in New Haven at a support rally for the people who were victimized in Charlottesville. I believe it was on College Street, correct?
That's right.
Was there anything, was there a sense when you were there? Did other people share your sense that it was odd that Jews had been singled out too at this?
Well, I mean, one of our perceptions at that particular rally was that there was all this talk about, you know, opposing fascists, opposing Nazis, even specifically Nazis.
And so they had somebody from
Yet they
from
forgot
each
to mention that- one thing. They forgot to mention one interesting fact about Nazis, which is that they kill Jews.
I had to go up to the guy afterwards because, you know, they had a Latina speaker and they had an African-American speaker. They had somebody from a Native American group, I think somebody from disability rights. And so I went up to the guy afterwards who was kind of moderating this rally. And I said, you know, you didn't mention the fact of anti-Semitism, but those people in Charlottesville were explicit about wanting to expunge Jews from the notion of who is an American. And he said, you know, you're right. You're right. And he actually went back up and made a statement about that.
Were people still at the rally or had it moved on?
It did a little bit dispersed.
My understanding was that most of them were gone. They already gone off on a march.
There were still some people.
How did you feel about that whole experience?
Which one?
Well, I'm a person who is always going to fight the fight, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so for me, you figure out, okay, what is the constructive next step? I'm not going to just be alienated by that and say, forget it and walk away.
No.
Because ultimately, the underlying fights for justice are too important. And so you've got to figure out what is the way that we continue to build the solidarities. The idea of tikkun olam is not that you're going to heal or fix the world in one step. If the world is broken, then this is something we are obligated to work on repairing, but we start the process, right? And we jump in to a tide and we keep going. It's an ongoing process. And actually, you were talking about sort of whether there was a divide between how religious Jews and more secular Jews perceive their relationship to Judaism, their grounding in Judaism, and therefore their relationship to the social world. And if you think about Abraham Joshua Heschel, I mean, and the kind of work he did as both a religious person and you know, a person who wrote so many important Jewish spiritual texts, but also was always out there on the lines with the civil rights movement. And he said, you know, whoever, whether a person's good or evil, whether they're blameworthy or not blameworthy, all people are responsible.
Right. And you're responsible for listening to Chai Haven on WNHH-FM, your home for community radio, New Haven at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenpenn.org. I was just interrupting you. Sorry about that, Jim.
Oh, yeah. No, I was just going to add to that that our friend and colleague Steve Fraud, who's a specialist in ancient Jewish texts, pointed out in an article that the translation of Torah as law is actually a mistranslation that came about during the its translation into Greek in the 3rd century BCE as the Greek nomos. He said that Torah means teaching, and so that means it's a more dialogic, a more interactive, a more processal sort of thing. So we're always in performing, you know, in trying to get justice and trying to get tikkun olam. We're in the process of teaching and of learning and of in a communicative relationship with other human beings who are in the struggle with us and with other human beings who are at this point not in the struggle with us.
And I think we have to get out of hierarchical ways of thinking about our relationship with others in the social world. So, for example, on Rosh Hashanah, I was asked to read a passage from
at synagogue.
Yes, at during the services from the Humash, from the book for the services, the prayer book, and it was something to the effect of bless the people who give charity, bless the people who help the poor, bless the people who do charitable works, bless the people who feed the hungry, and certainly these are important acts, but I feel like there's something kind of patronizing or condescending in that formula if it stands alone. And so as I stood up there on the bima reading this, I also had to add in a line that said, and those who will work in solidarity with the poor and all of these different people to create a better social world.
Yeah, and can I add also, you asked Paul at the beginning of our conversation to ask Jennifer, well, Jen, you know, you've published these books, you're a full professor, you know, with tenure at Yale of all places, you know, and yet you're being arrested. And I think that's a really, really important point to follow up on. Because sometimes we as, you know, intellectuals, as whatever, are in a position to be called on for our expertise. And Jennifer has great historical knowledge of the history of social movements, which is really valuable and people should know, and she should be called on in that role as expert. But I think it's equally, if not more important, that those of us who do have some, I don't know, prestige, some position in the social, intellectual, etc. hierarchy, to enter into the social movement without that, to just enter into it as a person, as a Jew, as a citizen, as someone who is just going to be in the movement
and both
with
of you,
others.
Both of you have done that with the movement to unionize graduate student teachers.
Absolutely.
At Yale, and there was a protest tent erected on Beinecke Plaza in front of the president's office. Yep. This spring, and that there was always concern, when are they going to try to tear it down? And you guys, I saw you guys hanging out at that tent quite a bit. Jennifer wrote a piece that people read nationwide about it.
Yeah.
You slept in the tent, right? Oh, it's actually like a bow shed. Jennifer, what was it like sleeping at Beinecke Plaza on
right.
those cold early May mornings?
I have to say, I cannot believe that I slept on Beinecke Plaza. So, during the first week of that occupation and the site, which I have to say was, we really have to stop and acknowledge what an amazing thing the graduate students did, because they took an open plaza that was essentially dead space. Right. And that it's just used as through space. People walk from one side of the campus to another by walking through there. And they actually turned it into intellectual space and social space.
And moral
where,
space.
Right. Where people would come. They would discuss ideas. The graduate students would do teaching
Jim Berger was there playing music. What was it, French horn?
I was playing my euphonium, thank you.
Sorry, euphonium. Somebody correct me. I think I called that a French horn. We put the video and someone corrected it.
Right.
Euphonium.
And I, I held one of my workshops there. And so they were actually doing the work of the university, plus calling attention to legal requirements and ethical evasions of the administration. But the students were, you know, obviously concerned that the police would come and they would dismantle it. And so there was one night where they did want a faculty person there with them. And so I agreed that I would spend the night there and I would take the arrest if the police came. And because the fact is Yale University was avoiding its legal obligation and legal requirement to engage in collective bargaining with a certified, legally recognized union. And so I had my sleeping bag and I had my jacket and I slept on the plaza of Bonnycutt Library. Yes, it was raining and cold, but you know, I felt like it was an important thing to do. And there was one point in the middle of the night where two police cars drove up, and so we quickly got up and in formation and were prepared to be arrested if they took us off, and then they drove away, and so we sort of slept there. You can't really sleep on the you know, on that surface. And then they have these birds that start chirping at 5 a.m. We were wondering if they were Yale birds.
Well, and actually we didn't get much time because we're about to run out of time here to talk about, in addition to putting your bodies on the line, including to marching, to strategizing, and I think the biggest sacrifice of all, sitting at long meetings where people argue a lot about what to do. You guys are also involved in the larger debate about how to respond to the Trump era and social movements. Yeah. And Jim, you've been carrying around a book that I just read that really blew my mind. Obu, it's called, about that kind of distills a lot of these discussions about how do we fight back and how do we do it with integrity in a meaningful way. There's no byline, there's no author's name on the book, but you've been the one handing it around all the time.
And I'm its conduit.
Do you want it as a end to the first of all, what is the name of the book?
It's called The Obu Manifestos. It's published by Dispatches Editions of Spite and Dival Press.
And OBU stands for two things.
OBU stands for One Big Union, which of course is the old International Workers of the World slogan.
It wasn't the International Workers of the World. You would have been failed out of David Montgomery's class. Anyone who calls it the International Workers of the World.
Oh, sorry.
That's why I ended up not taking the class. He said that the first day, and
right.
I knew I was not
going to
write it as Industrial Workers of the World.
Industrial, you're right.
Right. Big Union, and what was the
One Big Union and Oligarchy Busters United.
And this is idea, there's humor in it, and it's also dead serious, and there are ruminations about where we should go to resist the sort of trend in the country. Do you want to give a reading of it as we're on our way out of the show?
Sure. Sure. I'll read one quick bit from Obu Manifesto number 8.
It's a series of manifestos. I recommend it to everyone to read.
Thank you. 42. It is astonishing, Obu considers, that the left is as weak as it is, considering that its ideas and goals are in fact held so widely. But these are private views. We all believe we must fight poverty and inequality, racism and environmental destruction. We are willing to sign petitions, post on Facebook, give a little money, even occasionally give some time. But this is in the role of private citizen, compassionate and irate individual. In the aggregate, our primary public activities are work and consumption. We earn money and we spend money, as much as we are able. Our primary public role is participation in the market, and yet the power of markets, that is the presumed, fictive, usurped, yet still quite real power, is at the center of our problems. That is our paradox. We are conjoined to the agent of our exploitation, and so we must reimagine not just our political economic world, we must reimagine ourselves.
All right. Okay. And we'll continue doing that.
Right.
For now, thank you
for giving a shot. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, I do just have a final statement. We have a basic right of freedom of assembly and freedom of association. And that is often what makes possible so many other rights. And we are going to need to defend that very rigorously And the police and the state are raising the costs and the stakes of being able to do that. And so I think, you know, it's only by acting collectively, thinking of Tikkun Olam as a collective project, that we really are going to be able to meet those stakes and to defend what it means to live in a free and just society.
Amen. Amen.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you, Jennifer Klein and Jim Berger, for all that you do in New Haven and for being today the guests on High Haven on WNHH Radio. Thank you, everyone, Paul, for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now, we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all week long here at WNHH, your home for community radio.